Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 86, where Greta, Pedro, Sarah, and Tom are discussing Mark Granovetter's classic article, The Strength of Weak Ties, published in the American Journal of Sociology in 1973. In part two, we will examine the article's legacy as network theory has grown and expanded. We will also apply the article as a lens to discuss contemporary issues. If you missed part one or to get the text, they are available on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. Well, we covered a lot of ground. This was a relatively short article, but a very powerful one. And it brought to mind a number of examples a little bit more contemporary. I mentioned before about ideas of cohesion, social cohesion. I was thinking about bringing this to the contemporary time and what this whole literature stream tells us. What is it that people can do with this? What does it mean to be a bridge, for example? How do we, especially in the COVID environment, where we are that much more isolated from each other and in a lot of ways still working to cope, to find ways to cope into this new pandemic/post-pandemic era, what we can learn about networks in order to make them more effective and to be, say, for ourselves, to be able to build these weak ties that apparently have such an important role to play.
So the concept of the bridge that Tom walked us through with the diagram and the way that the bridge should represent the only path between two points is actually brought up in a small footnote, as with many things in this article, later in the paper, about bridging ties being hop-skip links, which is a jolly way of recognizing their efficiency, and they're a way of making the social group or the network efficient. And I think it's interesting because it's connected to part of the conclusion, or the major conclusion, that says personal experience of individuals is closely bound up with larger scale aspects of social structure well beyond the purview or control of particular individuals. So we are talking about what does it mean for the individual to be a bridge? What does it mean for an individual to find herself in a bridging role? And yet Granovetter is still careful to remind us that this is larger than the individual herself.
So I think this becomes particularly relevant, and we already hinted at that in part one, when we were talking about, for example, the management of innovation, right? In the episode of Tushman, we talked about how, in his case, he was studying R&D laboratories, but it could be any kind of context in which innovation is desired. So new ideas are so important. And we learn from here, from Granovetter, is that the way through which they are probably going to enter is through these weak ties, right? So there is all the questions of how do you nurture that in a particular work setting? What kind of people are that you need, and what kind of activities do these people need to do in order to create these ties, right? And some of this, there's of course ample literature that examines that. But I think what is interesting, and there is also a hint at that, some of the downsides of inhabiting such positions, right, that can be advantageous and important or even essential when you look at the broader scale. So how much an R&D labs depends on novelty and communication from outside. But at the same time, maybe the potential stress of being the person that's trying to inhabit two spaces or nurture all sets of ties with a range of people outside one normal social space. So there's also this double role, so to speak, of the point, right? That what the work that goes into performing such bridging, being that person, and the challenge of trying to manage those kinds of processes is anything but straightforward.
Well, what it comes to mind is, depending on the type of a collective that we're talking about, to what extent does it demand or prefer strong ties? And does it influence its individual members to seek strong ties in order to be more, I don't want to say homogeneous, but maybe that's the word that comes to mind right now. When we think about why was it that strong ties were viewed as so important before, the sense of cohesion, the sense of being able to operate together as a strong unit. This also kind of reminds me of when we did Tristan Bamforth, the coal mining pre-longwall method, where strong ties from a small team was important. And the term social fabric kind of comes into mind. It's a very apt metaphor here because in a way, if we're talking about a society or a collective in which weak ties are emphasized for their ability to provide flexibility or whatever, that's a different kind of a social fabric. It's kind of like a smaller thread count in the sheet, if we're going to carry that metaphor too far. But yeah, in Tristan Bamforth, the breaking or the changing of the method changed the way in which the organization worked. And there was a sense of loss, or there was a sense of we lost something when we went to this new method that broke what we considered to be the importance of having social ties between the foreman and the workers who were directly underneath that foreman. Now, in contemporary society, I think there is still a strong connection. Perhaps it's a mental connection or a cultural connection between strong ties and cohesion and therefore effectiveness or therefore efficiency or therefore some other outcome that is desirable.
So I listen to this, and what seems that you're saying is that different network structures matter differently for different workplaces, right? And I think the parallel with Tristan Bamforth and the coal mining is very interesting because those are particular contexts in which we expect lifetime employment, strong ties, and that the strong ties have such a powerful role because it's about trusting each other in a very dangerous operation. Right. And then we were talking about innovation. And when we think of innovation, we think about knowledge work, project-based work, and this whole idea of the fluidity and the necessity of the broader role that weak ties have to play, because you want to be able to get knowledge, share knowledge, get ideas, circulate all this kind of information. Right. But to complicate that, what I was thinking while listening to you is that to what extent in a setting like innovation, in which we know that all these weak ties are important, in which they have all this role to play for all this kind of knowledge acquisition and sharing, also can be a source of issues such as secrecy that is broken, ideas that get stolen, right? The extent in which not only that knowledge is imported, but the risk of that is leaked, the risk that may come if there is not strong ties, in which that your ideas are just going to know go around.
Well, I think the connection between tie strength and cohesion comes up in the conclusion where he says explicitly, strong ties breeding local cohesion lead to overall fragmentation. So he does take it on head on there. But it also is brought up as a future research question, future to the 1973 paper, but current to all of us. What is the relationship between strength and degree of specialization of ties, or between strength and hierarchical structure? And so the tension there is between cohesion and hierarchy, right? If you start out equal, strongly connected through multiple identity groups, deeply coherent, and then you move into a more hierarchical structure, what happens to that social fabric, we've been calling it, when the hierarchy emerges?
So maybe we can bring up some examples here to explore these ideas a bit further. And I think what has been underlying in our conversation is, for instance, the nature of the work being carried out. For instance, you know, in the coal mining versus, you know, Tushman's study innovation context. And for instance, in an innovation context, you know, you try to generate new knowledge, new ideas, new materials, new technology. And so it's very important to have that cross-fertilization of ideas, to explore different leads, traces of information. So for instance, if you're thinking about a classical R&D unit in a large multinational, you know, having coffee conversations, having lunches with people in other teams is very important to have that bridging between groups and have that flow of information. But when you're thinking about a production setting, and you can think about coal mining or, you know, a production plant, stability, institutionalization of work practices, optimizing production, not changing things all the time is very important. So there, reliability is very important. And close ties, knowing how you can depend on others, whom to ask for what, who will follow up when you finish your shift, all those things are important. And so it might be that the nature of the work that you're doing, where you're positioned in the organization, what your job role is, determines what ties to cultivate and with whom is good for you. And in terms of, you know, we haven't touched upon it yet, but for instance, the idea of, you know, we know that new ideas often come from the periphery, but how come that they are not always being picked up by the organization? How come, you know, one organization can pick them up and why does the other not? Because these ideas from the periphery have to travel to the core. But there seems to be something, you know, perhaps, you know, hierarchy, or what are the factors that sometimes prevent knowledge to be shared, even though there are plenty of weak ties.
Yeah, and what you highlight in my mind is the challenge of timing, the challenge of when, because these ties, please correct me if I'm wrong, but these ties strike me as very dynamic, and that if you're in an organization where strong ties are preferred, the use of a bridge would seem to be some sort of a stimulus, possibly an irritant to the organization. The article itself, we mentioned in part one that it's assumed that all of these ties are positive, and it was left sort of to further research to talk about negative and all that sort of thing. You know, let's just say that you are successful in an innovation and you have come up with this idea and have the path to operationalizing it, scaling up and scaling out, and therefore moving this idea to the core. It has certainly been found that because the innovators, innovative individuals have preference is not the right term, but their tendency, their ways of functioning tend to be in the exercise of being bridges, don't necessarily function as effectively or efficiently if they actually become more of a mainstream member of the organization with the strong ties. And sometimes with these bridges, I can imagine how those bridges could eventually become strong ties of themselves if it turns out to be the source of some new major service or product that the organization is coming. What does that do to the innovator? Not everybody is able to cope that way. So it's a very dynamic setting that we're talking about.
That's an interesting reflection, Tom, because it shifts us to think that it's not just a photography, but it's a movie, right? And we tend to think of this whole idea that the ties is this kind of more stable pattern. But I wanted to return to something also that Greta said, which is the extent in which how do the ideas travel, how hierarchy plays a role, but also something of what Tom said in terms of when all this bridging can be an irritant to some kind of organizations. And I think there is an answer there already in the paper, because among the main examples Granovetter uses, there is also the one about rumors. And I think that gossip is a great example of a lot of these mechanisms, right? For good and bad, because it can be the one through which someone in the periphery would be able to be heard at a particular place. But at the same time, it could be where things get blown out of proportion and all kinds of misunderstandings emerge from. Because as they move through the grapevine, all these different ideas, the content which being moved changes, right?
And there's a nice connection there to his 1985 AJS paper, which I hope we will have a potential future episode on, talking about reputation and all the other negative social evaluations when they are market and hierarchical forces, and in general, how the role of concrete personal relations and structures or networks of such relations generate trust and discourage malfeasance. So I think that is a foreshadowing, what you've brought up is a foreshadowing there from the next paper that we can take up about the role of establishing a reputation when you have a larger set of weak ties, or how do you establish that reputation moving out of where you had strong ties and you didn't even need one. You might have had a perfectly formed reputation when you didn't need it. And now you're moving into this more prevalent weak ties where you need it and you need to establish it and establish a positive reputation and not just what he calls the ratio of cheating opportunities to non-cheating activity as well.
One of the things I was thinking about is, you know, this either or, you know, strong or weak. And I was thinking about the nature of our ties nowadays with, you know, all the technologies we have at hand. For instance, if you look at your Facebook friends or your LinkedIn connections, there might be a bunch of them that once were strong ties in the sense that, you know, you met them, you know, perhaps a couple times a month, like your former classmates. And now you hardly see them anymore, like less than once a year. In the Granovetter's definition, that would be a weak tie. So I, you know, has there been a change in the nature of our ties as technology was oriented towards the fostering of ties beyond the interpersonal to maintain them, even though we're not in the same locale anymore, in the same workplace or the same school? And how does that change things?
Yeah, and there's a very, very important difference. Like when I think of social media and I think of my use on LinkedIn, and we're changing from a relationship essentially involving communications between an individual and another versus sort of a broadcast setting in which you post and it's available to everybody. And you actually don't know unless somebody explicitly likes or explicitly enacts on it whether or not it was received by anyone. And so our understanding of, excellent point, Greta, because I was thinking about how do we really know the difference between, say, a weak tie versus something that is more the equivalent of what we said in part one, waving at the person driving on the street, where there was interaction, but it has no real depth or meaning. And I think some of this, because and I'm sure there's a lot of literature looking at this from the social media perspective, I think this is one of the reasons why maybe people get frustrated or we get concerned about social media usage, because we are generally accustomed to the idea of being able to understand the feedback that we get in our interactions with others. And then when we have nowadays people who are lacking that interaction and who are judging themselves, the self-worth, on the basis of how many likes they get, because that's the only way they know, that is something that is a bit concerning, and it has been concerning. I don't know the science behind what's, you know, how people are looking at that, but I think that has definitely been in the news in the past few years.
So this is very stimulating, and I think that I have an example for us all that we know very well, which is the podcast, right? Because when we talked about technology, and thank you, Greta, for bringing this up, one way to answer would be that, you know, social media and all of that just dilutes our real connections, and we move, as Tom very well said, in this more broadcasting model that is not even, it's even hard to actually properly define what kind of tie is there, because it's not really a tie, right? And as Greta said, some of the ties that were strong, they become just avatars that like our pictures, you know, because they once were classmates and whatever. And instead of maybe re-seeing them in particular events, we just have this more mild, continuous, extended connection that is never very physical, it's never very strong, but it's just there, always in the background. But at the same time, technology allows us to create ties in a way, I think, with improbable ways. And I think the podcast that we are doing right now illustrates that, right? Because I don't think that all of us ever met face-to-face. And some of us, at least, for example, I never met Tom face-to-face, for example, right? I think I saw Greta and Sarah. But, and you know, we can, if you want to go broader, there is the case of Linux and all of these big online collaborative kind of efforts in which people are able to work together and accomplish complex tasks, so to speak, right? In ways that would be perhaps unthinkable before, right? I think so there's these two sides that social media, the internet brings, that in one way creates this more, it dilutes the ties, but also allows for connection formation of a different time and different scale in a different way.
I think one point that we haven't touched and is not in Granovetter's article is that the perception of those ties, of the perception of their health and whether they're strong or weak. And I was teaching this last week, and we were talking about network pruning, essentially, that the evolution of your network and the ebb and flow of your longest serving friends and when they get to still be considered your best friends and what is the standard of that. And one of my students brought up an example of whose door could you knock on at midnight? And she was saying that she felt she didn't have a very good network. She didn't have a lot of close friends because she only had 12 people whose door she could knock on at midnight. And they would let her in and put the kettle on without any questions asked. Now, everyone else in the class's jaw dropped to be able to say 12 people who you could turn up unannounced in a state of emergency in pajamas, you know, and say, let me in, and sit there and disturb their night and sit up with a kettle or, you know, beverage of your adult beverage of your choice. And her perception was that this must not be enough or this must not be very good. It's something I want to get better at because I only have a dozen. Whereas somebody else in the class said two or three, and it better be those two or three, and they better say the same about me. And obviously that's not something that's in here. We've already talked about the individuals who participated in these studies reporting different quote-unquote usage or different engagement with the people they were reporting on. But there was never that follow-up question about what they thought about that, how they felt about that. And that's the difference between taking a structural, as Pedro's been telling us, and an analytic view, a top-down view of these networks and the connections in these networks versus, again, in the next article in the quote-unquote series, an embeddedness view of it and looking from inside out and generally thinking about bringing the perception back in. That's the difference between an analytical sociology moving more towards the physics history that he talks about here in this article versus going back to a more social psychology perspective-taking view on it. And I think that's clearly missing in this, as you said, it's a short article and people are being reported on rather than a more Goffman approach of sitting with the people in the cafeteria and asking them about it or a White approach or a Harrison, you know, White approach of standing on the corner and asking them.
You make some great points, Sarah, and I'm for instance thinking about, you know, whether, you know, a person is an introvert or an extrovert, determining, you know, their internal ideas of what you should aim for in terms of pruning of your networks. And another context that I was thinking about based upon your conversation is, you know, when we look at, you know, labor markets, what we see is a tendency for the bridge to be replaced by not being a person, but being a technology. And we kind of see two trends. We see the trend of LinkedIn, where the technology is built to show how you're connected and who you're connected with and how that matters. And then we have, like, you know, the technology, the algorithms that are embedded in, you know, online labor platforms, for instance. Think about Fiverr or Uber, and that's connects you with people you have no ties with. And in a sense, it's more revolutionary, right? Giving the opportunities to people that are completely outside of your network and giving them a job. For instance, you know, an Uber rider coming to your house by you using the app, and they make a little wage of giving you a ride. That would have never happened if the technology would be based on the assumptions of that are embedded in LinkedIn, because there you would only reach out to, you know, your first connections, your second line and your third line. And, you know, even though you might be three handshakes away of that Uber driver, the just-in-time, on-demand nature, the technology matches differently. It's not the connectedness, it's the availability or the geographical location that happens there. So I was just thinking about, you know, how do we feel about the interpersonal connections and those bridging ties is so important in finding the jobs. And that's, you know, really where some of Granovetter's empirical work focused on. If we think about, you know, the people that are being left out, you know, For instance, think about university graduates in Kenya, people in places of the world where they have a good degree, but there are no employment opportunities for them. And, you know, we cannot all move to the West to find jobs. Think about, you know, how everybody moved to San Francisco and then housing prices went up, congestion went up. But bringing the jobs to where the people are, what should be the mechanism and what can be the role? What are the ideas that should go into the technology? Is it the interpersonal connection? Or can we create a trust through other ways that perhaps are more just and fair for people that don't have the ties yet?
Yeah, I have a couple of thoughts on that. First, on the Uber and the use of technology. And this goes to an example of where, you know, when we're talking about the strength of ties, that in a way, you know, technology is trying to enable us to afford weaker ties or less strong ties with the people in which we work with in order to facilitate some things. But it also kind of represents, like, for example, there's controversies here about food delivery services where the food deliverers, who are gig workers, are doing things like sampling the wares in the order on the way to delivering them and that sort of a thing. There's a cost associated with building strong ties, stronger ties, which would equate to stronger control, stronger conformity to what is the collective norms that I think in the early days of these types of services that was perhaps thought of as being like something we didn't have to invest in. We could go ahead and set up this service that people could work in and provide the service. There would be less of a burden or less of a cost associated on the company. And this is now starting to change as the shortcomings of that. So in a way, this notion of do we see strong ties, the existence of strong ties being important for the collective to assert an identity and incorporate values and weed out those who are perhaps shouldn't have been picked up in the first place. I see this as kind of like a shifting dynamic. There's a pendulum swing going back to say maybe we need to have stronger ties because lack of control creates opportunities for these kind of problems.
I don't have really a statement or a reflection, but I have a question from what I heard, which seems to be around to what extent all these network dynamics are related to opportunity, right? In light of changing technology. And I think that what Gret and Tom have been highlighting and leads me to ask, and I don't have the answer, is that in a time in which we have potentially more ties or at least more connectivity, right? In which there are different logics and criteria through which people get assigned gigs or can connect and reach out to people or just see an advertisement, right, on a LinkedIn job. What becomes then the role of the weak signals or actually the strong signals associated to weak ties, right? Because the paper already says that to know about an advertisement that everyone knows is not a very good predictor that you're going to get the job. Because, of course, we always knew that, unfortunately, all these informal maneuvers and who do you know matters, right? So one can wonder, in this situation, do these personal networks become more important? Are other types of weak ties, some which are related to, I don't know, influence exchanges or resource exchanges that becomes further hidden when the general connectivity that everyone has and who knows what is visible on a LinkedIn platform, you know, what happens to all of that?
Those are great questions, Pedro. And again, it makes me think about, you know, the evolution of a tie, moving from weak at some point to being strong, being weak again. And thinking about, you know, the current conversation on the role of technology as being the bridge rather than, you know, this person, what ideas go into that? Because, you know, with the Uber app, you suddenly have that connection with the rider, but then it's gone again. So that rider, you know, it is at the hands of that algorithm to provide you a ride again. If this would be LinkedIn, you would connect with each other and that connection would stay. So it might bring the opportunity to a person that wouldn't have had that opportunity before. But after that, how can that person take the opportunity further afterwards when the technology breaks the connection? And how is that different from the interpersonal being a person being the bridge, a human being the bridge?
Pedro, I think this flags also what Granovizor summarizes in the paper is the difference between an extended network and an effective network. So what is the size that you can create through care and feeding of network ties, as Greta's talking about? And then what is the size and health of the effective network that you can mobilize when you need to? And to answer both of those, I think you absolutely need to do a bit of a thought exercise the way Greta's describing, which is you need to think about what happens in the absence of this. So even going back to the diagram that Tom walked us through, and this is certainly the way that network scholars think about it, is what happens when part of the one end or the other of that bridge disappears? Or the people who are sharing the bus who are only acquaintances, what happens if one of them gets hit by the bus, right? The proverbial hit by the bus. And you have to think about what happens in the absence of this, especially in the platform introduction or in the temporary tie situation. What is the cost socially and economically when that tie is severed? Because the platform is taking up the space, the platform is holding the weight if you need to. And I thought when you were bringing it, walking us through the platforms before, the first one that came to mind for me was TaskRabbit, which is the small jobs service, the local short-term singular job service, which was absolutely what we all should have, would have used to use near neighbors for. So geographic propinquity, the actual person next door to come along and help lift the other end of the sofa. Whereas TaskRabbit has popped in for the situation where you don't have your neighbor for whatever reason, and you can now rent a neighbor to lift up the other end of your sofa. And I thought that was where we might be going with that because of the overlap with the communities that we studied as well. Like I just think if you could do the sort of quantum leap exercise, if those residents of the communities of the West End and Charlestown would have been told in the future, your grandchildren will ring up or will use a tool to find somebody else to hold up the end of the sofa or straighten your picture or help you hang some wallpaper. They would be horrified, even though in this example, they were being contrasted for what they were and were not able to do with their effective networks. They had very big extended networks, but different degrees of effect and success. I think what they share is that both of them would be surprised to know that the network had changed enough that neither of them would then be able to achieve these simple neighborhood tasks. Never mind the more onerous social and caregiving tasks, like who takes you to the hospital, who picks up your kids from school if you can't pick them up, who brings you groceries at the beginning of a pandemic if you're elderly and don't know how to shop online. And all of those kinds of social tasks, which I know we've discussed elsewhere on the podcast before about women's work and care work and how those get picked up. But just thinking about the kinds of interactivity that would have generated these ties. So I think it's useful to think about them at both extremes, when it doesn't exist yet and we're generating these ties, and then also at the death of them or the absence of them, what would the effects be? I think pushing the thought experiment to those extremes and testing the boundary conditions of it really shows us then what the essential function and the essential nature is.
Definitely. And I was thinking about this, you know, initiating a task, for instance, you know, the task of carrying the other side of a couch. The task is short. You need to initiate it. You need to find somebody to do it. But then the sustaining of a task, for instance, if you think about, you know, a person cleaning your house, you could find somebody on TaskRabbit to do that for you. But, you know, what we see in the platform space is that these platform models don't really work. People prefer to take that relation off of a platform. And, you know, when you think about a cleaner in your house, you know, they see a lot of personal stuff. You would want to trust them. Ideally, you would like to trust them that much that you give them a key to your home, that they can come when you're not there. And the task is sustained, you know, every week it's again, and it, you know, it's so much hassle to to get a different person all the time and say like, hey, hi, how are you? Can you fold my laundry and, you know, clean my bathroom and get the hair out of it, you know, the drain? You ideally would like to have, you know, one person rather than the entire world to do that for you. Again, I think that, you know, the nature of the task and thinking like, what is it that needs to happen, you know, at an individual level, at a community level, and what is the nature of the ties of the network of the structure around you to make that happen? It really, the paper got me thinking about those questions.
You mentioned a really, really important word, trust. That's something that has probably gotten a lot of attention and probably deserves a lot of attention, because when we're talking about, from a practical sense, how effective or how we perceive our network, trust is a really big variable, but it's not one that I know that I can very rigidly or rigorously define. What I'm getting at with just in general with a lot of these discussions that we're having, a lot of it is kind of fuzzy to measure, isn't it? You know, what is strong versus weak, or what is a trusted versus a non-trusted, under what circumstances or whatever? And it would seem like that would be something that, well, it's probably generated plenty of scholarship trying to nail down.
I don't have a fully formed thought either on this. But I think that we are introducing here is the element of money, right? And it's like not only how the features of different platforms, the extent we are able to see, who do we know, who do we know that know who we know, and what kind of connections we have. But as we navigate our daily lives, the people that we trust, the people that we hire for our task, the ways in which we advertise something, you know, all of these interdependencies we have with people around us, how not just the fact that it's happening digitally, but the fact that there are different ways through which we can pay for certain activities and relate to each other, right? It's colored when both the technological type of arrangements that are in place, the Uber driver, and the fact that you just show up, but also the kinds of mediation that money brings to the tie that we form and the value it has and the strength or weakness it has and so on.
And that's directly taken up in the 85 AJS paper when they talk about networks versus markets versus hierarchies. And when is it money? When is it trust? When is it governance? And when is it reputation? And how those different factors function. And really, again, together, these two papers for me are the birth of meso-level theory, along with all of Merton's work, which we've discussed in the other episodes, but are the birth of meso-level theorizing for organizations and economic sociology as a subfield, and really trying to make that separate from organization theory to this point.
So if I may probe you on that as our final words of wisdom, and what does this meso-level approach, which I'm a big subscriber of, tell us about organizations and management and work and all of that?
It's a big question that we've started to pick up a movement for at last year's Academy of Management. We tried to build a meso-level, certainly in organization behavior, a meso-OB movement. And Granovetta says it here in the paper that the linkage of micro and macro levels is thus no luxury, but of central importance to the development of sociological theory.
I think the embeddedness paper could deserve a separate episode to kick off that conversation.
Yeah, that sounds like a wonderful thing, a wonderful topic to take up for another
you
time.
You sold it, Sarah. You sold it.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.